This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Vimala cooks, everybody eats. That's the motto of Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe, a popular restaurant in Chapel Hill. Vimala Rajendran is serious about everybody eating. She's been cooking since she was a small child in Mumbai, where she helped feed a constant crowd of family. When she moved to America as a young bride, she cooked to bring the flavors of home to her husband and children. For Vimala, food is love, and it's also a means of survival. She started cooking for more than friends and family when she found herself a young single mother in Chapel Hill. A reputation as an underground cook brought people directly to her front door. Her weekly community dinners led to the opening of her restaurant, which was financed without a bank loan. Instead, many individual investors who had enjoyed her home cooking for years helped her launch her dream. Now the motto rings true inside the restaurant. No one is turned away. When Vimala cooks, everybody eats. And Vimala Rajendran joins me in the studio now. Welcome to State of Things. So good to have you here.
Thank you, and so glad to be here, Frank.
Take us back to that childhood in Mumbai. You're grinding spices at 6 years old?
Even earlier than that. I was about three when my mother handed me cardamom, and she would say, here, peel this, because I was relentless in her kitchen, always hungry, bugging her to get the food to the table. And so she said, if you're so impatient, come on, help me.
You want to cook? You want to eat? Cook. How many siblings? How big was your family?
Three siblings. But at that time, when I got an early start with my mom, I was an only child, not because I was the oldest in the family, but because my parents moved to Bombay, leaving my older sister in Kerala with grandparents.
So was cooking a family affair? I mean, is this kind of common? Everybody gets involved pretty much at an early age?
Helps in my out. Family, it was. At least for me, it was. My parents both cooked, so which may have been unusual at the time. My dad cooked, and I remember my dad teaching my mom to cook.
Wow. So, what was that? You say it was probably that unusual for men to be cooking? And
maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not something that I saw all men do. But my father taught my mother to cook a lot. My mother was very young at that time. She was married when she was 17. Hmm. She had her first child when she was 18. And my memories of her began when I was about three. So she's about 23 when I remember her in Bombay without a whole lot of equipment. We had a mortar and pestle, and that's how she ground her spices, and I would play with it. And I had some play cooking utensils. So I'd have those beside her in the kitchen, and I'd do play cooking, and then soon graduated into using real things.
From clay pot to clay pot.
Exactly.
Well, actually, there was no clay pot cooking.
Or there was.
With
mm-hmm.
her,
yes.
Know. Well, what was her specialty? What was your mother's specialty?
She cooked fish really well. Fish was hers and my favorite, and we always shared fish heads together. My mother was a very good cook, but I didn't think so all the time. There were times when I introduced new foods to her and actually expected her to cook it the way people on the street cooked it or my friends' moms cooked it. So I would be teaching her to cook during some stages of our life together.
Oh, now this is street food that you've
yes.
become fond of.
Yes.
And what's the difference?
Street food is fast. It's crunchy. And in India, street food then and now didn't use refrigeration. So the food was deep fried on the spot or before. So there was something very enticing about it because it was junk food and it was snack food. And I still think back and I laugh about trying to hurry through dinner with my siblings, especially my older sister and I, and then running out the door immediately after dinner to capture street food.
You know, we've had a lot of guests on this show who've talked about growing up on the tobacco farm mm-hmm. and sharing. You're the first guest we've had who's talked about sharing fish heads with your mother. So I want to point that out before right. we go uh-huh. further. Now, did you cook in college?
Yes, I did. I started experiencing street food only when I finished high school. That's because my parents steered us away from it, saying mm-hmm. it was unhealthy. And so in college, I started eating out a lot. And then I would buy groceries and bring it home to my mom, and she and I would cook together, or I would cook for her or for the family. So when I was in college, unlike students who go to college here, I didn't leave home to go to college. So I went to my classes from my mother's house.
And then came home and brought her the delights of street food, which
and cooked more.
Did she embrace it once she saw that she could, you know, have a little more control over it? Did she feel a little differently about the health value of that kind of food?
Well, I don't think she ever thought there was great health value to the food, except she and I figured out healthier ways of preparing it in terms of sanitation in the home.
So now you left India first for Canada, then for Ann Arbor, Michigan.
The other way around. I first came to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I was about 21 and pregnant with my first child.
All right. And so was it your husband's job then that took you?
Yes. He was on a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Michigan Hospital.
How was that transition for you?
It was hard in some ways. There was a lot of newness to the beauty of the campus. I came in the month of August, and I remember everything was so clean and beautiful and colorful. I could go barefoot on the lawns of student housing, and we had an instant collection of friends. Others in the same situation as in immigrants who had come there for academic purposes. Some were women and some were men, and then there were some who were dependent spouses like me. So those who stayed home and didn't have school or work all socialized in the daytime also, or even late at night and on weekends. So that's one place where I practiced a whole lot of cooking that wasn't inherent to my mother's kitchen.
Did you find that interesting? Did you want to learn about American cuisine?
Yes. So the first set of people I described weren't American. They were people from other parts of India. But I had an unquenchable interest and desire to learn American cooking also. So I remember meeting an English woman who invited us for a meal and made us lasagna that I didn't find very palatable. So then when I shared that story with my American host, whose husband was of Italian descent, she said she would have me over to watch him make lasagna, and I picked up a very good lasagna. So to this day, I can make lasagna like you wouldn't believe.
Wow.
Very good.
Well, I'm not surprised. So you found some community there, both the expat community and some Americans as well. What about your feelings for home? Did you find you were missing home very much?
I missed home and still do. And there was a time about 3 or 4 years ago when I sent out an email to one of those lists that you mentioned, where I said, I'm searching to find out where home is, and now I've come back to Carborough, and this is home. I don't think it's a set matter. I think the feelings of home will always be mixed for an expat like me. I remember India every day. There are some things about it that I miss, but I'm very much at home here. So that is the duality that I have now reconciled to and will live with for the rest of my life.
Well, and eventually you did come to Chapel Hill. And what do you remember your first encounter with Southern cuisine?
Yes. As a matter of fact, my first job in Chapel Hill was to work in a daycare in the north side of Chapel Hill, community school for people under six. And we picked up the food from the Baptist Binkley kitchen, or it was delivered, I don't remember anyway, on the rotation of the food for the daycare that the teachers shared was a whole lot of Southern food. And I liked it, and my intrigue to find out how it was made, especially fried chicken barbecue, Eastern barbecue, started then, and I'm continuing to discover it.
So you did work to figure out how to make this stuff when you started to taste it.
And I would ask Southern cooks how to do it, and I would, you know, attend church suppers or fish fries and go behind the scenes. If I just stopped and pulled over by the side of a road to participate in a fish fry, I would want to know how they did it, and I would be peering over the stove.
On our program today, we are talking with Vimala Rajendran. Her restaurant in Chapel Hill is called Vimala's Curry Blossom. Our conversation will continue after a short break on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with Vimala Rajendran of Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe in Chapel Hill. We were talking before the break about how you were able to find community, make community here, still thinking of your homeland back in Mumbai. But all of this time, your marriage was, in fact, fraught with violence throughout this period.
Mm-hmm. I never understood how I put up with it, even for a single day, because of the upbringing that I received growing up. My father never even raised his voice to my mother or to us. He was a disciplinarian who taught me a lot of life's principles that I still live by. And he set the standards for a loving, peaceful home. So as a daughter and a feminist who came out of that family and having received high quality liberal arts education in India, to be hit shortly after we were married was a shock. And the only reason I didn't get help, I believe now, right away, was because this was not an arranged marriage. I chose him. We chose each other and eloped from home to get married. So I felt like I had to work this out, lest I prove myself a failure. And I should have known my parents would never have thought of it that way. But that was one of the reasons. And then, of course, then we had children. Especially when I had two daughters and no son and no plans to have a third child. Being that the children were girls, I wanted to make sure every day that the girls knew that this was wrong, that abuse was wrong. And it's after my son was born, of course, there's passing time and maturity happening, but I knew that the marriage had to end or the violence had to end. It's one or the other. I couldn't keep taking it. At times it seemed like physical violence didn't matter. I could recover from it. But there was emotional abuse, put-downs, just questioning dignity and sanity on a daily basis, telling me how stupid I was, which I know I never was. Recently met a number of former high school classmates of mine who remembered one thing about me for sure. There were two things that they remembered, but one thing was that I was the smartest in the class. And my parents affirmed that. So emotional abuse compounded with physical abuse. And then when that proliferated into and spilled out into making the children scared on a daily basis upon the arrival of their father, I knew I had to leave.
Were you talking to anybody about this? Did anybody else know?
Throughout the years, say if I've lived in the marriage for almost 2 years in India, several years in Carrboro, and then almost 3 years in Canada, and then another 8 years in the U.S., before I left him, I've only spoken to the people in Chapel Hill about it. Perhaps because by then, Oh, I didn't talk about it in the beginning because of fear of being found out by the perpetrator, and shame, or having no outlet, and you know, what's the purpose? You know, I didn't think I was going to leave the marriage, or if it was even possible. The reason I could speak to people in Chapel Hill was because I had some deep relationships with my neighbors and friends who happened to be, like an answered prayer, social workers. A social worker friend of mine's husband was actually running the change program at the Durham Coalition for Battered Women. How convenient was that? And the two of them kept their hands on my pulse. And week after week, they would check in with me to see if I was ready to, you know, use the resources. I kept getting educated about the resources that were available in the community. I started building a relationship with the Orange County Women's Center on Henderson Street in Chapel Hill. There were board members from the Women's Center who were my neighbors, who also happened to be social workers. So that was very helpful. And I knew the most powerful thing that I could hear, that they wouldn't let me starve. And they would be there for me. But they also, you know, gave me literature that I now, you know, share with others. And that is, you're never alone, and there is a path out.
Mm. It's interesting to hear you say this, though, and tell that story, knowing that you went into it with all of the intellectual architecture that's required to understand that this is wrong. You had that, the strength, the intelligence, the awareness as a feminist and exposure to feminist literature. And yet it sounds to me like it was both the presence of professional help, something different than just knowing the difference between right and wrong, actual professional help, and then a loving community that really was the difference for you.
Yes,
is that true?
It was. Yes. And these people are still my friends. They never shamed me or judged me for the duration it took for me to actually make the decision to leave. Were never impatient with me. I learned so much about grace and understanding from these folks. Personally, I always banked on my own faith and spiritual strength to live day by day. And forgive the wrongdoer and truly move forward in my life.
How did you actually make the decision to leave?
That was not easy, right? A couple years before I actually left, the violence had escalated and my daughter called the police. And when the police came to the door, you know, I would stop here and say, India's country code is 91, and she obviously dialed 911. The police were told that that was an accident and there was nothing wrong. So someone was just trying to call India. God alone knows I was not allowed to call India. So there was an arrest made, and upon duress, about a few weeks later, I dropped the charges. Since then, North Carolina law has changed. The case is never between the victim and the perpetrator from now on. District attorney from the Orange, the then district attorney, Carl Fox, and many others and legislators had a lot to do with changing the laws. So now the cases are between the perpetrator and the state of North Carolina. And I'm glad to see that happen. Anyway, after I dropped the charges, there was no actual violence for almost 2 years except threats. And even then, because there was no intimacy in the marriage and the emotional violence and abuse was continuing. And as I said, it was even spilling out onto my growing girls. I knew I had to leave. The decision actually was made unknowingly, I must say. The timing, I did not plan it. I had a neighbor who invited me to a church service the day before Thanksgiving. Leading up to that Thanksgiving, somehow there was no food in the house. For about 6 months, the father had stopped providing for the family. So he would say, you've got to fend for yourself or go back to your parents' house, leave. So all kinds of things that didn't make any sense. So the children and I were huddling together. And as Thanksgiving came, a friend invited me to this church service, which was called a Thanksgiving service. And I had never stepped foot in a church building in America before that day. But all the songs, everything was making me feel like these words for me. And there was some prophecy spoken, and it was spoken in a strange tongue. It was translated by the person who spoke it. And the words of that prophecy was, come follow me, I will provide for you like I did for the Israelites in the desert. Your prison walls will be crashed, your chains will be broken, come follow me. And I thought of this as the voice of God, and I know that it is because of my faith. But that day I went home. I was not even missed. I was gone for about 2 or 3 hours. My daughter, Manju, knew that I was gone. I had gone to church. But a month went by. The next day was Thanksgiving Day, as a matter of fact. And there was absolutely no food in the house, just a bag of potatoes that I had picked up from the IFC pantry on Wilson Street in Chapel Hill. We were going to take that to our neighbor's house, which was going to be our contribution. And the father tried to prevent the kids from going out of the house or keeping them busy raking the lawn. It was a bright, sunny Thanksgiving day in Chapel Hill. And dinner time was arriving, and I needed to take my potatoes and go over there. I think I sent Manju and Rajiv over, and Anjali stayed back with me. Soon I said to Anjali, let's get our shoes on and go. I gestured to her, and he realized that we were leaving the house, and he came running after us. I didn't think of that as a time when I was actually running away from home, just going to the Thanksgiving dinner, but he started chasing us down the street. Neighbors saw this happen, and he was in a tug of war with my 11-year-old daughter. And people called the police, and that was just a stone's throw from the Chapel Hill police station. The whole neighborhood filled with police cars. And in mediation, and when the police came, they asked the children where they wanted to stay. They all said they just wanted to eat a Thanksgiving feast. That's all they wanted to do. And both parents at the table. And the family that invited us invited him to join us, but he didn't. So I gave my word that I would bring the children back home and come home after dinner. But as the sun started going down that night, it scared me to go back. So I called the helpline in Chapel Hill, the family violence helpline. And a family lawyer was on call. I don't remember her name, and I was so naive, and I said, is it okay for me to fear going back, and would I not be going back on my word if I didn't go back tonight? And she said, it would be worse if you went back because of what just happened earlier today. You may want to reconsider not going back tonight. So we stayed back at the home of our friends.
But you really hadn't, at that moment, you still weren't thinking about leaving.
It didn't seem like we were. But that night, I became too scared to go back. And then the next morning, I knew I wouldn't go back at all. So what happened was I called the Chapel Hill police and told them that I needed to go by the house and pick up some personal goods. I left the children at our friend's home, and I went, and the father was not there. And I didn't have a key to the car. A neighbor who had keys to our home and our car came and gave it to me and said, "That's your car. You should drive it away." So I did, and I drove away a family minivan with just clothes and a few books and toys. That's it.
When you realized that this was it, that you had left, what was the most difficult part for you about leaving?
The hardest part was just the realization that a home with a garden and mature fruit trees, chickens in the backyard, and a neighborhood full of loving friends and neighbors, I was losing all of that. And my children were losing their neighborhood as we knew it. And I must now think back and say that still was the hardest thing. You know, losing the marriage of my youth, I think that loss happened as the years went by. There was nothing I could do anymore to save it. But to lose a home, a house, and a neighborhood and friends, everything changed that day.
And clearly, as you just said, you knew that this marriage was over and that part wasn't going to, you weren't going to miss that at all. And yet, as you told that story, the one moment that you became emotional and I wasn't sure if you were going to go on was when you said your kids wanted to see their parents together at that table.
Yes. And that was very interesting because, you know, my oldest daughter, she was born brilliant. Many of you listeners know how smart she is, and she was born an activist. Very early in her life, when she was 6 years old, she asked me, "How did he talk you into marrying him?" And I knew that she was wise beyond her years, and I wouldn't be able to fool her into thinking that everything was okay. This was not a fairy tale marriage. So the onus was even stronger on me to give her the right information and talk to her honestly and openly about how wrong this was. And she knew it. She had no moral dilemma about the right and wrong of what was going on in the family. And sometimes I wish I had left sooner. Hmm.
As you look back now, you talk about especially the emotional abuse, calling you stupid when you know you're intelligent. And now, of course, you've got your own business going. It's very successful. You're a very confident woman, business person, community leader. When you look back now, how do you see yourself in those years? How do you characterize what was happening to you intellectually and emotionally?
As far as domestic violence goes, my situation was a little bit different from some. And that is because I was not a U.S. citizen. So the fear of deportation under strange circumstances of not having custody of my children or possession of, say, my educational transcripts, etc., was a fear that I always carried with myself. And you keep saying, Frank, that I own a Curry Blossom Cafe. I'm an accidental chef, and I want to talk about it a little bit. I defined career until I became a chef as something you did based on your most recent education. And all my life, I just wanted more and more education, and I got 10 years of post-secondary education, which included two master's degrees, one in political science and one in educational media technology. With the latter degree, I did television production, co-founded the People's Channel, DCM, and produced live and documentary television shows and films. When I actually tried to get a paid job in any of those areas of instructional design or television production, I didn't have a green card.
We're going to take a break right there. Finish that story when we come back. Talking to Vimala of Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe. Our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Vimala Rajendran, who emigrated from India as a young bride, survived domestic violence, found a community and liberation, in fact, through food. She now runs Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe in Chapel Hill. And before the break, you were talking about making the transition from that marriage to
yes.
where you are now.
So I was saying I didn't have a green card and therefore could not have a professional job related to any of my, recent degrees and such. Years went by after the separation. And upon separation, by the way, those who know immigration law will understand that if I was a dependent spouse, then I didn't have a status. So I was a non-status immigrant in custody of three American-born children. So with my instructional design graduate degree, some applications were made to get a job as a media specialist. And then 9/11 came along, and the company in Chapel Hill that applied for my visa suffered some financial exigencies, and that application fell through. So the lawyer came up with the new plan, which was to have my oldest daughter be my immigration sponsor. So she had turned 21 and was eligible to sponsor a parent. So she did. And that process took another 4 years. So soon after I got my green card, I applied for one job, and that was at a local food co-op, and I didn't get a call back, even for an interview, even though if I stood in the aisles of the bulk foods, folks would be asking me how to use quinoa and what's the difference between couscous and quinoa. When that happened, I had to rethink my career, and I just launched the cooking out of my home with a new found vigor and just increased the frequency, went to a weekly dinner, and started going out and serving the food out of the lawns of Weaver Street Market. Some of those would be fundraisers for nonprofits that I'm a part of, but also taking the food to Johnny's Coffee Shop in Carborough and serving it for profit often. But I must say, not finding a job immediately after getting my green card was kind of a shock to me, because people would often say, oh, we would hire you in a heartbeat if you had a green card. And I decided I needed new education, sort of a terminal degree, a JD or a PhD. So I tried to go to law school. And the whole process of trying to go to law school took about 4 years. And I couldn't get my transcripts out of Bombay University in a timely manner, and that took a while. But finally, when all that got lined up, and I took one last trip to India before starting law school, I found out that someone had forwarded my email announcement to serve food at Johnny's to the Orange County Health Department. And I got a call asking if I was serving food without a permit. Now, this is a Friday evening at 5 p.m. My response was, yes, I do, and I would like to know how to apply for a permit. So the person sent me some information by email, asking me to go ahead and look that over. And I said, I want to come in and see you on Monday. But before I showed up at the Hillsborough offices of the Orange County Environmental Health Department, we already knew where our restaurant would be, having decided to start one, having run into fellow food movement people in Carrboro and farmers and restaurant owners who all pointed us to this spot that we are in now.
Now, was this the result of getting busted, or had you been thinking about this before then?
Oh, no, I had not been thinking about starting a restaurant.
Well, it's interesting. I want to stop you there just to talk about this. These parallel tracks you're on. You've got an email list. You're doing takeout, right? I mean, people come into the door. You're cooking for them. And then you're bringing it to places like Johnny's and catering these nonprofit events, et cetera. You're enjoying it?
Loving it.
You're loving that. And yet you feel like, well, but I've got to, get a PhD here and get a real job.
Sure.
Well, was that, I mean, did you ever have sit down and have the conversation with yourself about what's wrong with cooking for a living?
Yes. I felt like the cooking that I was doing out of my home wasn't engaging me entirely and intellectually to the fullness that I hoped it would. Yes, I got the fulfillment of some of those desires in a boardroom as a, say, the chair of the board of the People's Channel. You know, I'm making policies. I'm a founder of that organization. Or I sit on the board of Hidden Voices. I have been active in the community organizing events or participating in, policy changes through movement work. Those were just small attempts, far and few between, on a daily basis, not having a workplace and something and a steady income was missing. So I never felt fulfilled.
Now comes the time when this is crucial now, and there's this idea that you can actually start a restaurant.
Yes.
How did that appeal to you?
You know, I should go back to my response to people who said, you must start a restaurant. Oh, this food is so good. At every potluck or any place I have served food, folks had been predicting that or suggesting it. And I would always say, oh, never. Now I know, never say never. There was absolutely no fear involved in the decision-making and the thought about starting the Curry Blossom Cafe. There was some question about what the name would be. It took some persuasion from family and friends to go with the name Vimla's. And now I get asked what the name means, and it makes a lot of sense given that we adhere so much to our deep-rooted philosophy of purity. The name means pure in Sanskrit.
Vimala.
Yes.
So you start the restaurant, and is it true you didn't get a bank loan?
We didn't even apply for a bank loan in the beginning because we didn't think we would qualify. So is it true that we didn't get a bank loan? That's not entirely true. We did apply for a loan with self-help here in Durham. And we got a small bank loan of $10,000 to buy our delivery van. That's all. The over $150,000 came from family and friends.
Were these formal agreements? These are formal investments?
Yes. We drew up legal papers that we called promissory notes with our lenders, as the promissory note tends to call them. I would like to call them friends. But they are lenders, and we have varying interests. Some said they didn't want any interest. Some set the interest rate on their own. So it's anywhere between 4% to 12%. So we are trying to pay off our higher interest loans first, and payments have just begun. We have paid back a good bit of that amount.
Were people telling you you can't do it this way? Because you know you can't.
Yes. Those who said that and believed it used that as a immediate reason to not loan us the money. Mm. And that's been okay. I can understand people's fears in these harsh economic times, but I must say a small business for what they do, like us, which is to generate these many jobs, and we have hired people who consciously spend the money back in our community. We buy from farmers who produce locally, and our workers go back and spend with the same farmers or with the small businesses in our towns, Chapel Hill and Carrboro and maybe Durham. Just enriches the economy so much. If Chapel Hill feels they have not felt the economic crash, it's mainly because small businesses like us are making a major contribution on a daily basis.
And these are individuals, friends, who become lenders and remain friends, who are investing in a business model that allows people to eat without paying if that happens to be their situation, if they can't afford to pay that rent.
Yes, yes. If you ask me any day, not enough people are using the Everybody Eats Fund. So here we are broadcasting that that fund, which is maintained on a gift card, is not just for destitute or homeless people. It is also for the working poor. If someone's lost a job recently or they're still working two jobs and don't have the luxury or the opportunity to go out to eat, come and use this card. It's for anyone for whom their budget for that meal that day is not what our cash register rings up. If you come to the restaurant and intend to spend $17 and it's rung up $25, you can just say, I would like to pay $17. We'll pay the balance from the card. It's just our way of saying affordable food, delicious and locally sourced, healthy food is a human right. And there's plenty to go around.
You have since remarried.
Yes.
Your husband, Rush, a big part of the operation. Does he help you?
Yes. He works nonstop. And I had no idea this man had this much knowledge in business management, personnel management, and stocks, purchasing. I meant inventory when I meant stocks. Okay. And maintenance. You know, he ran a maintenance department at Duke many years ago. So he can fix almost anything. And he's a very valuable asset. People, we are all blessed that we have him. And this, of course, we all, together we have many children who are all involved at the restaurant.
Are you surprised that this model is working?
Not at all, no. I'm a big dreamer, and I dream. I dream dreams all the time. And I remember speculating, even though I would never, ever start a restaurant, I would say if we ever started a restaurant, it should be a community center. Saying that, I did register a nonprofit about 5 years ago that was called New Youth Community Center. It was going to be a multi-generational training place for people to exercise their art and especially centered around food because I believe food breaks down barriers and the dinner table is a place for conversation and, you know, movement building.
Right.
So, yes, I'm not surprised.
You just got back from a trip to India.
Yeah.
A class reunion, high school reunion?
Yes.
How did it go?
The whole trip was very interesting. First of all, before I left, I spent many, many hours training a few very capable people to do what I had been doing. So the recipes had to leave my head and get on paper. And they did a great job. You know, Rush's son, Stephen Greenslade, could go back to India and teach people to make sambar today.
Mm.
Phil McLaughlin, Damon Lapus, Rush himself. I have the cutest story. He called me one day and he said he had offered dal vada, which is like the Indian cousin of falafels, to 250 people. And I said, who's going to make that? And I'm in India on the phone. He said, I've always wanted to make it. So I told him how to make it. The whole process of giving him the recipe took over an hour. And he made it. He standardized how to make it so well. It is, it was a big success. And when he saw the list of ingredients, this is what he said. Oh, wow. That's why it tastes so good.
So, what about when you tell your story to your former classmates? What do they think?
So at the reunion, it was like time travel. Not having lived in India for many years, having been gone from there for about 32 years, I had not seen these high school friends for about 37 years. So folks would come up to me and say, do you remember me? So what I did was I planned an exercise where if I remembered someone, I would also remember one good thing to tell them about themselves. And I did. That turned out to be a fun game. Folks remembered some nice things about me, too. So that's a lot of fun.
Is your model, do you think, scalable? Is it replicable? Does it need you as an individual, your unique personality to make this kind of business model work? Community sponsored, community financed, and with a sense of communitarian responsibility to those who may not be able to pay.
Frank, I'm going to pick apart just one word out of your question and say, address it. And that is, you asked if you should be a part of it. By going to India and being there, I realized that I am not indispensable to this business. And some principles, though, are, you know, calmness, faith in your own ability, peace, love for your neighbor, and joy in what you do are intricate. So we are a triple bottom business, triple bottom line business, people, planet, and profit.
We are all grateful for it. The food is great and the philosophy equally good, as you might imagine. Vimala Rajendran, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Vimala is the executive chef at Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe in Chapel Hill. You can check it out and all of the menu at Vimala's Curry Blossom. Vimala, by the way, V-I-M-A-L-A. And that's our program for today. Thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.